Charlotte Talks is sponsored by Mazda of South Charlotte, committed to bridging the gap between adventure and adventurer by helping people select vehicles that fit one's lifestyle. More at MazdaofSouthCharlotte.com.
This is Charlotte Talks. I'm Sarah D'Elia, in today for Mike Collins. A trial by jury is a cornerstone of the American judicial system. The Sixth Amendment of the Constitution guarantees, among other things, a speedy and public trial by an impartial jury. Hollywood has helped to shape our understanding of this process and idealize it through court dramas such as Law and Order and films including the classic 12 Angry Men.
This, I have always thought, is a remarkable thing about democracy, that we are, notified, that we are notified by mail to come down to this place to decide on the guilt or innocence of a man we have never heard of before. We have nothing to gain or lose by our verdict. This is one of the reasons why we are strong.
But it's a muscle that's rarely flexed these days. For several decades, jury trials have been more seldom, both in criminal and civil cases. In a report last year, the National Association of Criminal Defense Attorneys warned of the extinction of jury trials, finding that fewer than 3% of federal criminal cases go to a jury. A similar decline is happening at the state level in North Carolina. Fewer than 1.5% of criminal cases in superior court were decided by a jury in the 2017-2018 fiscal year. And even if a case goes to a jury, what's to say it will be judged by a jury of your peers? A concept that's not actually guaranteed by the Constitution, although the Supreme Court has weighed in on it over the years. Drew Sherrod is worried about this. He's a longtime researcher of jury behavior and a trial strategist, and he explores the reasons why fewer cases are going to juries and what he sees as the consequences for democracy in his book, The Jury Crisis, What's Wrong with Jury Trials and How Can We Save Them? Later in the show, we'll hear from Charlotte criminal defense attorney Darlene Harris and get her thoughts on why juries aren't seeing as much action. But first, Drew Sherrod joins us by phone this morning from Santa Fe, New Mexico. Welcome to Charlotte Talks.
Good morning. Happy to be here.
So if you'd like to join the conversation, particularly if you've served on a jury, we'd love to hear from you. You can email us at charlottetalks@wfae.org, tweet us at Charlotte Talks, or comment on our Facebook live feed. So Drew, starting with you, your book is called The Jury Crisis, What's Wrong with Jury Trials and How Can We Save Them? So let me start off by asking you, why are we seeing this decline in juries?
Well, first, you know, the numbers you gave, I think the numbers are even a little more dire. And the numbers you gave us for the death of trial by jury. It's often called the death of the jury trial or the demise of the jury trial. I think the most recent numbers are that 0.5% of all the civil trials filed in a year ever reach a jury, 0.5%.
Wow.
That compares to about 20% of all those cases about, say, 20 or 30 years ago. And on the criminal level, it's less than 1%. And this is combining across federal cases and state courses. You know, there are cases. There's federal cases and state cases. You file them, put them all together, and you get a similar decline in both state and federal cases. And there are even interviews with federal judges who talk about, I think there's about an average of 5 federal trials a year per federal judge. And they talk about how there's so little going on in their courtrooms. As they walk down the hallways, they hear their footsteps echo off the marble.
Wow.
So,
wow.
It's important to realize that, as you said, it's guaranteed by the Constitution, the Sixth and Seventh Amendment, trial by jury, and yet it's vanishing.
So are trials by juries, are they not as appealing to defendants, or what's happening, what's making them vanish?
Well, on the criminal level, they're being replaced by plea bargaining, and that's the situation where an accused person confesses to a lesser crime to get an automatic lesser sentence. On the civil level, they're replaced by summary judgment, which is when a judge reads, each side files a motion and the judge dismisses the case. Or more likely what's happening these days is binding arbitration. In almost any contract you agree to, say from a cell phone contract to a gym membership to hospital overnight, you have to agree to waive your right by trial by jury in case there's a dispute. And if the Sprint contract on a computer, if you just read it online, it's in very black, bold print several times, repeatedly. If there's a dispute, you agree to waive your right to trial by jury and submit to binding arbitration.
Hmm. Well, to take a step back for a second, this is something that you dive into your book. Where did the idea, the concept of a trial by jury come about? How long have we been doing this?
It's so interesting. Officially, it was enshrined in the Magna Carta in 1215. Jury scholars think that actually it arose in Saxon tribal villages before that. So it's a pretty ancient tradition. And so for about 800 years, from 1215 to, say, the end of the 19th century, jury trials were very, very simple. They would, a jury in, say, medieval England would handle about maybe 15 cases in a day. And then they would deliberate, they would retire to deliberate and handle all those cases at once. So there was seldom any time for a review, consideration of the details of the evidence. In fact, there were no attorneys, there were no witnesses. The earliest days of trial by jury, they would just assemble a group of people from the village, and they were always men, they were never women. And there were people of equal status, like farmmen, yeomen, farmers, knights, nobles. And they would come together, and somebody would read the charge, and then they would discuss, not even on, there was no evidence, they would just discuss on what they knew to be the nature of the accused person. What was it? Basically, they would reason on gossip.
Wow.
And this had been officially referred to as self-informing jurors, meaning there was no evidence, so they were self-informed. And so part of my book argues that jurors are still self-informing today.
Mm-hmm. Although when you hear that, you can breathe a little easy that we've come a little bit farther than from where we started. But the Sixth Amendment...
Well, we think we have.
Well, we think we have. The Sixth Amendment states that the accused shall have the right to a speedy and public trial by an impartial jury. But where did the idea, where did the shift come of a jury of your peers? When did we start to see that happen?
Well, I think there's always the goal because, as I said, in those early trials, there were always people of similar rank. So when the crowns, the king's officer would come in, he would assemble a group of people from the village, but they would be if the accused person was a farmer, the jury would be made up of farmers. If it was a noble, it would be made up of nobles. So yeah, that was the goal of the earliest trials, and it's gotten harder and harder.
Mm-hmm.
Now, you could even argue, how do you have a jury of one's peers in a class-stratified, economically extreme, racist, sexist society?
Well, it's not an easy job to be a juror, and there are a lot of stereotypes that come along with serving on a jury, and you get into those in the book. But, you know, the stereotype of somebody that doesn't want to be there, they're missing work, they're not compensated well. Trials are lengthy. They can go on for weeks or months. So how do we get people excited to actually be fulfilling the civic duty that if you're summoned and chosen to be on a jury? I mean, how do we get people to want to be on a jury?
Well, for one thing, jury duty is pretty unpleasant. It creates a great uncertainty in your life. You show up, it's in a a badly lighted, poorly designed sort of public space, like a big courtroom. You watch dumb videos. Most people don't like it, and I think it's reasonable. However, it's such an important task as a civic duty. So I think you have to expect that it's not going to be. It won't start off great, but most people I've talked to who have served on the jury end up finding it ennobling. Most people do, have rather sort of routine, kind of dull jobs, and trial by jury creates a real lively notion of something important going on in the world and in their lives. They really sit down and reason together to talk about whether somebody should be punished or not, whether corporations should pay hundreds of millions of dollars or not. It's a major decision. And I think it does stretch and ennoble people.
Well, you mentioned in the book, too, that we're all narrative creatures. We all kind of bring a story, an idea of what may have happened in a case. And sometimes that's fine. I mean, there is a narrative arc. There are closing arguments. There's opening statements, and those can create a story. But how do we get over jurors bringing that personal story, that their own narrative to the deliberation room? Is that something that needs to be addressed that's not working in the system right now?
I think the answer is you don't get over it. Everyone is biased. Everybody brings the biases. Everybody brings what's called in the jargon stored scripts from their lives. So when they hear evidence about a case, they immediately start telling a story. There's a very nice body of research called the Story Model of Jury Decision Making. And they took an actual case from Boston, a murder trial. They reenacted it, hired actors, staged it, exactly everything that was said. All the presentations were reenacted. Then they recruited people who were jury qualified to be on an actual jury in that venue. And they had people watch the video, the film, and tell a confederate of their searcher what was happening. And it turns out that people start telling stories almost immediately. As soon as they hear information about a case, they start framing it in terms of episodes from their own lives, their stored scripts. And it turns out that, this is kind of an amazing figure, almost half of what people talk about during deliberations was never presented in court. It comes from their stored scripts and their stories of their own lives about something similar that happened to them. And different kinds of people tell different stories. So, and then the stories you tell influence their verdicts. So this storytelling, this narrative arc that we sort of intuitively provide, it happens at the very beginning and continues throughout. When people deliberate, they essentially tell their version of the case. And then people hammer out how different stories work out together.
Well, you've helped conduct a lot of mock trials and interview jurors extensively after trials are over to gain a better understanding of why a jury deliberated it the way it did. And it's an interesting point because we don't often hear from jurors unless they decide that they'd like to be interviewed by the media. What other facts have you learned from jurors about their deliberation process that the general public would be surprised to know?
I think these post-trial jury interviews are really my favorite part of having been a jury consultant. Because after a trial that may have lasted for several weeks or even months, you call up these people, and some people are just done with it. They don't want anything more. They just almost hang up. Other people just really need to ventilate. They need to tell what the whole experience was like, who decided what, why people decided, you know, who got in fights, who almost had to be expelled from the room. For example, we did a lot of major pharmaceutical cases, and there was one case in which the allegation was that a drug was given to a woman one day, and the next day she got symptoms throughout her whole body, and so whether or not the drug could cause these symptoms. There was intense and complicated science cases put on by both the prosecution and the defense. And then I called up the jurors and talked to one man who was quite articulate, but he said basically the science just went over jurors' heads. And the whole case depended on between a plaintiff scientist and a defendant scientist and multiple scientists on both sides trying to make a case that the drug was either harmful or safe. So this man said, he said the science just went over everyone's head. Nobody understood it. And then he went on to say, I'm not Einstein. I'm as blue collar as you can get. I just didn't understand this case. So we decided, based on the simple story, that if she got the drug one morning and the next morning had symptoms, the drug must have caused it. And I think that kind of thing happens over and over. People do their best, but that's their limitations.
Mm-hmm. Have you ever been summoned to serve on a jury?
No, I have a nice little story. You know, I've often been summoned, and one time I actually showed up, and I was among the people who were waiting to be interviewed to see if we could be alternates or not. So they were doing the voir dire, which is when you the judge and the attorneys question the juries to see if they were biased or not. And the prosecuting attorney was a woman who went down each of us who were still in the pool to be possible alternate jurors. And she said, do you promise me you'll keep an open mind and not make up your mind until you've heard all the evidence? And each person, she would ask them, and they would say, yes, ma'am, absolutely, of course. She got to me, and I kind of did that equivocation thing where you bob your head to right and left. And she said, she pointed to me, and she said, what does that mean? And I said, well, the research shows that most people actually make up their minds before they've heard any evidence. And so it's really interesting. She just swept towards the jury and she threw up her arm and she said, ignore everything that man is saying. Ignore everything he's telling you. And then a few minutes later, I got this big fake smile and she said, we thank and excuse Mr. Sherrod.
We need to take a short break. You're listening to Charlotte Talks on WFAE.
Charlotte Talks is sponsored by Mazda of South Charlotte, committed to drivers that believe a car is used for more than just getting from place to place. More at MazdaofSouthCharlotte.com.
This is Charlotte Talks on 90.7 WFAE. I'm Sarah D'Elia in for Mike Collins. Tens of thousands of criminal cases are handled in North Carolina each year, but very few of them make it to a jury trial. That figure has been declining across the country to the point that a longtime researcher of jurors and trial strategy worries about the extinction of the jury system. Drew Sherrod has written about what he calls the jury crisis, and he's one of our guests this morning, as well as Darlene Harris. She's a criminal defense attorney in Mecklenburg County. We want to hear from you. We hope you'll join the conversation. Email us at charlottetalks@wfae.org, tweet us at Charlotte Talks, or comment on our Facebook live feed. So, Darlene, we've seen that the numbers of jury trials are vanishing. As an attorney, what do we lose when less of your cases are going to a jury? What's at risk here?
Freedom. I think that when you look at the options that are presented to people, it's a very tough decision for people to make. So depending on the level of the crime or the nature of the crime, the alleged crime, you know, they have to make a very important decision. And one thing I think that one of the problems that I think we're seeing is that people have lost faith in the jury process, right? And rightfully so. There are so many trials where we look on television and we say, how could they have possibly decided this, right? But you know from sitting in one of my trials with me how much the public knows that the actual jury never even hears about until maybe after or never at all. So I think that when you look at the options that people are presented, even if you're presented with a low-level felony, the risk of going before a jury and potentially becoming a convicted felon is very scary. I mean, how much do you lose from becoming a convicted felon in America?
And I remember the trial that you're referencing was the trial of Raekwon Boram, who was facing first-degree murder charges for the shooting death of Justin Carr. And I remember that there was such concern over the jury pool being tainted that the judge asked for jurors to be brought out one by one so they wouldn't be influenced by the answers of other jurors. That's how, you know, sacred the jury pool was, kind of trying to be kept as not tainted by each other's answers. Drew, this is something that you've talked on in your book, and Darlene, I know you've written about this as well, the concept of being judged by a jury of your peers. Drew, I'll start with you. Why is it problematic? Why is it so hard to get a diverse jury, a jury that maybe has somebody that looks like the person that is on trial?
The first thing is, there's a recent study that shows that I think 15% of people who receive 15% of jury summons are returned as undeliverable because people either haven't left a forwarding address or they never bothered to do that. Another 12%, I think, they receive the summons but never act on it. That slices off a quarter of the people. Once you get that quarter out of the pool, then the people who show up still are subject to, they can be excused for cause. And in state cases where judges are elected, they're very lenient in excusing for cause. Or they can be excused for, they can be struck through peremptory strikes. And I'm sure Darlene has views about that too. But I think peremptory strikes are used too broadly and improperly, and they amount to just sort of random guesses. And they're often used based on a sort of an implicit sense of who's biased and who's not biased. And they're often, it become racial choices.
Darlene, do you have any response to that?
Yeah. So, I think we discussed this, I actually was summoned for jury duty while I was during the Raekwon Boram trial, and I didn't even notice until a couple of weeks later. I don't check my mail very often. I know this is something that is fairly common, and so I think part of the issue is, you know, how people are receiving this notice. You know, how are people receiving this information? I think the other thing is when we're looking at the issues, the underlying issues, right, the core issues of how hard it is to get a jury of your peers, especially for minorities, black males, you know, on the jury that we had no black males. And there were very few options. I think in a pool of 52, we had 3 or 4 black male options, and that stems from a lot of things. When you look at some of the systematic issues that are in place, things that prevent you from serving on a jury, such as being a convicted felon, and we know how the House laws disproportionately impact African-American males. And so just that part will lead a large part of that out, a large part of African-American males. But then also, in order to be selected for jury duty, you have to be either a registered voter or you have to have a driver's license. So those two things, you take those two things, and the decline of people becoming more the decline of people being interested in registering to vote. I mean, we're seeing a lot of issues with the previous elections about people not even voting, people not even registering to vote. So that also removes a significant point of a significant amount of people as well.
Mm-hmm. So what do you do as a defense?
I just wanted to add it in. Mm-hmm. Some states are much more liberal in who becomes a juror. So it's not just a driver's license or a register to vote, but if you receive public assistance. So that broadens the pool a lot, and it includes lots of the lower-end people who might not normally ever have responded to a summons.
Interesting. So what do you do if you are defending someone and you are faced with you have the jury that you have, and maybe there is nobody that is like your client, whether that's race, socioeconomic status? I mean, how do you approach that jury differently, or do you?
A lot of attorneys say that your trial is won or lost in jury selection, and I find that to be pretty true. When you look at just the strategy that goes into jury selection, if you end up with a jury that's not ideal, then you have to work with the cards that you're dealt. You try to become more aware of the dynamic, and you unfortunately have to completely re-strategize. And I think that happens fairly often. It's very rare that you ever get an ideal jury or you ever get the exact jury that you want. And so you end up having to strategize just based on what you've been given.
Mm-hmm. And Drew, do you have anything to add to that sentiment?
Yeah, I think that most attorneys don't put enough time in on jury selection. If you view jury trials as an opportunity for people to tell stories, then jury selection is selecting storytellers. So you have to know a whole lot about them. And I think too many attorneys don't spend enough time on imagining what kind of questions they need to ask. Like, attorneys still often use what bumper stickers are on your car, what are your favorite books, what do you watch on TV, as those indicate a person's biases. What really indicates the person's potential biases are very detailed questionnaires that need to be given out in advance that try to determine a person's whole lifestyle, values, anything in their life that's pertinent to the case at hand. And I know these are they're difficult to do, they're difficult to get judges to agree to, but it's really the only way you can do serious scientific jury selection, to have this very detailed questionnaire. And then you can look at it, you can study it, you can find out what kinds of issues predict verdict for various types of people. And it'll be different for different types of people. Because I've done so much of this jury research questionnaire that the kind of questions that identify, a wealthy older white male versus a younger poorer minority female, different issues are going to predict their likelihood to favor plaintiff or defense. So you need that detailed questionnaire.
Mm-hmm. Do we have that in Mecklenburg County, Darlene? Is that a tool that you have used?
So similar to what Drew said, a lot of the problems that you have are getting certain questions approved, getting the judge or the district attorney to agree to you even asking certain questions. You can request that happens, but I think one of the things that, you know, is also, you know, people have to remember is that juries are unpredictable. You know, no matter how many questions you ask, no matter how much you think you have the mind of someone, juries are very unpredictable. I remember a trial that I sat on, and there was one alternate juror who was dismissed, and he said, you know, you need this potential juror. I'm not sure how they're going to decide or what's going on there. And we thought this juror is actually going to be a problem, just based on the questionnaire, based on their responses to some of the things. How they behaved during most of the trial, you know, sleeping. But once we had the opportunity to talk to that particular juror after the trial, they were the most interested juror, and they were the person who was most on our side. And so just remembering how unpredictable these things are, you know, questionnaires are important, and I think that you can get a lot of what you need out of them, but also sometimes there's just an unpredictability to jurors, which again goes to, I think, the decline in people actually wanting to go to trial, is that they know, you see on TV all the time, you know, these crazy outcomes. So I think it all kind of goes together.
So let's say you don't have access to a questionnaire for whatever reason, the judge has declined that. What other tools are available to you as an attorney as you're trying to vet people on a potential jury?
So, of course, social media is becoming more and more popular, depending on it. I tell clients all the time, you know, be careful what you put on social media. You know, you think that your page is private, but it's not. There are so many ways that you can so many things you can find out about a person or that you think you can find about a person from social media. So looking into what they've put online, looking into kind of, I guess, more investigating their personal lives.
So will you be maybe like looking at what someone's been posting on social media as they're kind of up there answering questions?
So sometimes that's possible, you know, if you have an intern or someone who, and just their name, right? You hear a person's name and you find out so much information about them, you can just Google them, mm-hmm. you know? And so that is sometimes a tool that's used by attorneys.
I'm Sarah D'Elia in for Mike Collins on Charlotte Talks today. My guests are Drew Sherrod, a jury researcher and author of the book, The Jury Crisis, as well as local defense attorney Darlene Harris. We hope to hear from you on Twitter, Facebook, or you can email us with your questions or comments at charlottetalks@wfae.org. Drew, I feel like in the trials that I've sat on and the jury selection process, there are always a small handful of people who are very excited to be there and they really want to get on the jury. They feel really passionate about it. So what do you think makes a good juror when people are being vetted? What are people looking for when they make that selection?
You know, I think we need to sort of shift from the focus on jury selection, because jury selection is actually, I think it's fairly minor. There's only so many people out there in the panel. There's only so many strikes you can exercise. If you strike somebody, you really don't know who's going to replace that person, because it's on like random numbers. And so I think jury selection is overemphasized. I think what really needs to happen is that attorneys need to start thinking more like jurors and more like a juror's brain, more like the juror's brain works, and less like law professors. So this isn't really, trials really aren't contests of evidence. They're contests of stories. The storytelling even begins before jury selection. And to make jury selection even matter, you have to tell a story when you're describing what the case is going to be about. A really skilled trial attorney starts implanting a story at that point, and then they return to that story over and over and over. So the more important thing I would really advise attorneys about this, like, while jury selection is very important and the questionnaire is very important, and the idea is to figure out what kinds of stories your potential jurors will tell. Once you've done that, then the focus shifts to the attorney, who has to have a narrative, who has to tell the case story in a way that the human brain is going to jump on. Because we know from the very beginning that people are looking for stories. The brain evolved to look for stories. And so you have to tell them a story, and you have to use the story that organizes the evidence. And so there's just, you can't just make up a story, but the story has to pertain to the evidence and organize the evidence and fit the evidence into a moral narrative arc that people can comprehend. And that's what attorneys often ignore. And that's, I've written hundreds of 45-minute, 5-point narrative opening statements. And then attorneys can give it. And then they think that the next time around, they think, I've done it. And they'll show you their opening. And there's no narrative there. It's just sort of random points of evidence. So that's the important thing, is the narrative arc.
The narrative arc, okay. But if you're somebody who's like hoping to be able to be selected, I mean, is there like what are the qualities or should we be looking at the qualities, or I guess we should be focusing on the narrative arc, is what you're saying, of as an attorney versus maybe, I guess I'm just wondering, like, if somebody is really excited about the possibility of serving on a jury. And I know sometimes people are often like, they take it very personally if they don't get selected. They're surprised by that because they think that they could be fair and balanced. What are some of the reasons that somebody might get striked, where they're, you know, educated, they pay attention to the news? Why might they not be selected to serve on the jury?
I think attorneys often fear educated people because they see this person as maybe a potential opinion leader, likely someone who's going to speak up often during deliberations, and unless they're very, very sure of that person's position, they're going to want to avoid somebody who might be a loose cannon and who's going to take over during deliberation. I think attorneys fear that kind of person, and so they try to avoid people who are probably too enthusiastic, because unless they're very, very certain about which side that person will favor, and if it's obvious and it's a potential certainty, then that person is going to be struck by one side or the other.
Is that true, Darlene? Do you, if you see somebody who is very educated, listens to the news, is, you know, really excited about the possibility of serving on a jury, that that actually might hurt them and their chances of getting selected?
Well, I think it depends. Obviously, in a trial that you sat on, and we didn't want people who watched the news for various reasons. We didn't want them to have developed their own opinions. But I think it depends on the case and on the trial. If you have something that's a lot more complex, then maybe you do want people who are going to be able to understand that complex theory or complex strategy. But there are times where you want people to, of course, as a defense attorney, you want people to think a little less. You know, you want people to kind of just trust the narrative that you're giving. But I think it just depends on what the charge might be.
Drew, you mentioned in your book that it's getting harder because of the decline of jury trials. It's getting harder for attorneys to get that trial experience that's necessary. What needs to change to make sure that attorneys are getting that experience, especially if we do continue to see this decline in jury trials?
Well, they're not going to get the experience unless the trials happen. So the goal is to keep jury trials happening. So to do that, I think it'll be a kind of a long-term process, but jurors have to be respected again instead of dismissed. I mean, just I'd like to work in this one example. The recent Monsanto Roundup weed killer case in Oakland, a jury awarded $2 billion, $1 billion to a husband and $1 billion to a wife who worked together doing a lot of gardening and landscaping and using the weed killer. And the jury deliberated 2 days. 2 days of deliberation they couldn't possibly have covered much of the science. And so when I read some articles, I realized that probably what they were doing was, there was a nice story that Monsanto had tried to suppress research that went against them, that they tried to manipulate research, they tried to the strong case. So Monsanto has tried to move all their federal cases from California, saying that all of California jurors are biased. And so they want their cases moved to other states.
Interesting. Darlene, we have just about a minute before we need to take our next break, but I want to ask you, why would you maybe advise a client not to go to trial? I mean, what is that? I know we touched a little bit on it, but when you're laying out all the options for your client, I mean, what's the argument to be made that you shouldn't go to trial?
So it's very rare that we'll actually tell a client what decision to make. But one of the reasons that we would do that is just sometimes it just doesn't look good. You know, again, juries are very unpredictable. And even if you believe that you have all the evidence in your favor, there are definitely times where it just doesn't work out. And I think one of the things that we can consider most is the seriousness of the offense, what you're facing if you are convicted, what your age is, what your career is. All those things kind of go into play in making a decision.
We'll keep the conversation going and get to your comments after a short break. You're listening to Charlotte Talks on WFAE. This is Charlotte Talks on WFAE. I'm Sarah D'Elia. The Constitution guarantees a trial by jury, and it's embedded in our culture through TV, court dramas. But in reality, only a fraction of cases actually make it to trial. In North Carolina last year, juries decided fewer than 1.5% of criminal cases, mirroring a national decline in jury trials. Drew Sherrod has written extensively about the subject in his book, The Jury Crisis, and so has my other guest, Darlene Harris, a criminal defense attorney in Mecklenburg County. So we've established the problem and how we got to this point, but I want to end this last segment on a hopeful note, hopefully, of what we can do to actually restore the jury system. We'd love to hear your comments, your ideas, your thoughts at charlottetalks@wfae.org or search for WFAE on Facebook and Twitter. So, Drew, I'll start with you. Let's talk about some of the ideas that you outline in your book of how we can restore the jury system.
You know, one thing that's surprising is in lots of courtrooms, jurors don't really know what their job is. I mean, there are failures at various points, and the first failure is the judge's failure. Judges give jury instructions after all the evidence has been presented. That's equivalent to having, you know, picking people up off the street and sitting them down in a 6-week sort of college physics class, not telling them what the goal is until it turns out they have to take an exam. So judges need to make their judges' instructions much clearer, and they need to give them before the evidence is presented instead of after. They also need to allow jurors to ask questions. In most courtrooms, jurors can't ask questions. the most progressive courtrooms, the jurors all have a computer, and they can send a question to the judge, who then sends it to the attorneys, and the attorneys decide if they want to answer this question or not. So that's important, just changing the structure of the trial. And then having the attorney, as I've been pointing out, sort of harping on, actually, tell the story. Like, there's several opportunities to tell a story in a trial. The first is before the voir dire. The second is in the opening statement. The third is in the closing arguments. At each of those points, they ought to be telling a very coherent story that organizes the evidence. So if jurors can understand the evidence, they'll make fewer crazy, incomprehensible, ludicrous verdicts, and jurors will be trusted again.
We have a listener email. Mike emails us, as a trial attorney with 3.5 decades behind me, I really appreciate the program this morning. I would ask the guests to talk about the power of different words and how they influence the outcome. For example, how close were you to the victim? How far away were you from the victim? Same basic question, but will they elicit different responses? Darlene, I see you shaking your head, so I'm going to throw that one at you.
Yeah, I think that's a very important point. I think looking at how you frame things. We pay attention to that as well in jury selection. When you look at language like protest versus riot, right? That makes a big difference, and it kind of gives you an insight to how people view someone's First Amendment rights. So as a defense attorney, when you're talking, do you call this person the victim? Do you call them by name? What are you using to either personalize your client? Because I think that's very important. So reminding people through your language and through your words, you know, that this is a person. This is someone that has been through this as well. So I think that is huge.
One thing that I know you've touched on in your book, Drew, is note-taking and that being available for some jurors. And I didn't realize, and in Mecklenburg County, the trials that I've covered, jurors have never not been allowed to take notes. But that's not the case everywhere. In some cases and some places, you're not allowed to take notes as a juror. Why would a judge not want a jury or a juror to be taking notes, Drew?
I think it's viewed as jurors are distracted from the evidence being presented by the attorneys, and then they may miss points, and then the judges think that they really won't understand the case as well if they're allowed to take notes.
Yeah, and that's kind of like, I mean, if people are not legal experts, I could see that sort of be trying to like learn advanced physics and then at the end of 2 or 3 weeks being told, like, hope you remember what was in class day one. That's a lot to ask of people.
Yeah, especially it's depending on the length of the trial.
Go on, Drew.
The trial can go on. Even in the El Chapo trial, mm-hmm. that famous trial of a few months ago, mm-hmm. that went on for 3 months, and then the judge gave 3 hours of instruction. There was something like 53 verdict questions that jurors had to answer. And it's just not possible. The human brain can't do that.
We've got another question through emails asking us, can you talk about how some jurors are great for one kind of case but would be awful for another kind of case? Darlene, I'll start with you.
Yeah, so one of the things that we often have to pay attention to is so like with the trial that we had recently, we didn't want people who had lost someone to gun violence, right? So while you may be a great juror for a trial that you're dealing with drugs, right, whatever your personal experience is may hinder you from being on a murder trial. So paying attention to, of course, I know we talked a lot about the questionnaire, but paying attention to how they answer those questionnaires and listening really when they're talking about their personal experiences, because as much as we want people to be completely unbiased, our personal experiences are going to play into our decisions. And so, you know, you might be great for a drug case, or you might be great, you know, for the defense, of course, but not necessarily for a murder trial or a larceny trial because you've been robbed at gunpoint. You know, so I think that's very true.
One of the points in your book, Drew, that you make towards the end when we talk about restoring the jury system is the idea of being able to ask questions. I mean, jurors are oftentimes able to send notes to the judge during deliberations, but oftentimes the judge will respond with just rereading the jury pattern, and that's not always what the jury's looking for. They're looking for a little bit more guidance. Is there an opportunity that you see, Drew, for jurors to be able to ask questions more as the trial is unfolding instead of at deliberations?
Well, I mentioned that one example in the very progressive, high-tech courtrooms. You know, jurors may all have a little computer and they can send a question to the judge during the presentation of evidence, and the judge can decide if he wants to ask the attorneys if they would like to answer the question. But I think what would normally happen is most judges are just going to repeat the judge's instructions, which never made sense in the first place. I've written a little bit about the first Bill Cosby trial, and the jurors deliberated for longer than the evidence was presented. So the deliberations lasted 53 hours. The real evidence was 50 hours. And in the post-trial jury interviews by reporters, one person said that they spent a whole day deliberating on the meaning of the word reckless and what and different people thought. They were, now, reckless meant different things to different people. So they would send the judge a question about what is reckless, and the judge would say, you have to use your own common sense. And one other point here I'd like to make is that it's very hard to know, you know, what's the reality in a case and what's biased. We've done so many auto defect cases, and it turns out that defense jurors and plaintiff jurors actually see the facts differently. For example, like what's reasonable risk? What's a sufficient testing? What's an adequate design? Some people are people who worry more about accidents, who've been in more accidents, who feel they can't protect themselves against harm and hazard. Those people will appraise risk and design very differently than people who pretty much are in charge of their lives and think, I'm okay, I can take care of myself.
Darlene, what do you think of if there was, in Mecklenburg County this is not the case, but if there was more of that interaction between jurors being able to ask questions more in real time? Like, I'm interested to hear, as an attorney, would that be really annoying, or would that possibly help you to get more in the mindset of what narrative the jurors are hearing?
That's actually really tough, because I think it's important for the jury to have their questions answered, but I also think some of that uncertainty can serve well sometimes. Of course, as a defense attorney, uncertainty can be good sometimes. But in just thinking about how it would affect the trial, I think that there would have to be certain systems in place to where it's not an interruption like every 5 minutes or every 10 minutes, because also I think people are easily distracted. And so I think while, you know, one question might help one person, is it helping the other 11 jurors and alternates?
I'm Sarah DeLeo. You're listening to Charlotte Talks. My guests today are Drew Sherrod, and he's a jury researcher and the author of the book, The Jury Crisis. We also have Darlene Harris, who's a local criminal defense attorney, and we hope to hear from you on Twitter, Facebook, or on email, charlottetalks@wfae.org. Darlene, what are some of your thoughts of how the jury system needs to be restored from what you view in Mecklenburg County?
So I think one of the major things, I think there just needs to be a legislature overhaul. I think that when we look at how people are excluded, when we talk about felonies, even the most basic level felonies can exclude people from being on a jury. And again, we know that that disproportionately impacts minorities. And so when we're talking about a jury of your peers, that automatically removes a large part. So I think that just on a basic level, there needs to be an overhaul in legislature. I think also the other issue is addressing incentives for potential jurors, right? So I believe in Mecklenburg County, you're up to $12 a day for the first 3 or 5 days, and then after that, it goes up to $20 a day, and you're in court for 8 hours. I don't know many people who can afford to lose that time of that amount of time of work and only make $12 or $20 a day. So I think we need to look into incentivizing juries, you know, being on a jury, and remind people of the importance of serving on a jury instead of trying to dodge jury selection, you know. And I understand the woes that come with it and how boring and long it can be, but understanding that you have this civic duty. You have the opportunity to really affect and change someone's life for better or for worse. Mm-hmm. So I think that's something that needs to be in place, and also some type of program for, and, you know, I've mentioned minorities a couple of times, but especially people who are of lower socioeconomic status, right? So someone who is living paycheck to paycheck might be able to better understand someone who is charged with larceny or theft. They might be able to better understand someone who's stealing diapers or, you know, committing a certain type of crime. So I think trying to make it a little bit more reasonable for people to be on the jury.
And I think that's an interesting line that you'd have to work of trying to incentivize somebody, because you definitely don't want somebody to come to jury for a paycheck, right? But at the same time, what you're talking about with the hardship that many people have to face, taking time away from work and, like you said, living paycheck to paycheck. Drew, what are your thoughts on incentivizing jurors to participate in jury selection? Is good idea, bad idea?
You know, you can do it in two ways. You either incentivize or you punish. In some states, actually, if you're pulled over for a traffic violation, the officer can note that, I see you've received three jury summons and haven't responded yet. You know, I could arrest you for that. Mm. Probably your stronger incentive is going to be a negative incentive, like to avoid paying a huge fine for ignoring jury summons. On the other hand, California has a very, that's where I live normally. California's a really nice system where you call in each morning for a week, and you find out if you're going to be needed or not, and then you don't show up. So several times I've been on jury duty, and I've gone through that process, and each morning I call up, and because there are so few trials, they don't need jurors. So that makes it much easier also. And then the whole issue about, as Darlene was talking about, how paying people, I mean, it's pretty absurd to pay them so little. And what works out is you only end up with jurors whose employers do compensate them for jury duty. And then you get, and that's often civil servants, you get the juries comprised of a big middle of the population, and the extremes of education and income, and they drop out.
We talked earlier about how it's getting harder for up-and-coming attorneys to have that experience of having that trial experience of that having the experience of doing a trial in front of a jury. So, Darlene, how, with the number of jury trials on the decline, how do you stay on top of your game? How do you make sure that, you know, maybe you're not going to trial as much as you did a couple of years ago, but if you do have a client that is wants to do that, that you know that you're going to be up for the challenge of it?
Well, a couple things. I think up for the challenge is just going to be a personal thing, right? So I'm always excited about trial. I'm always excited about the opportunity to zealously defend, right? Zealously represent. But if we're talking education, I know that, and it's a basic answer, but, you know, your CLEs, you're staying on, there are a lot of programs for jury, for trial attorneys that you can do just to kind of keep you, like you said, on top of your game. SOG, and I'm forgetting what it stands for now, but they do a lot of trial prep things. They do a lot of, like, you can go to Raleigh and have mock trials and just things like that to keep you on top of your toes. Also, you know, I'm a newer attorney, so watching the more seasoned attorneys that are in trial, regardless of what we say about the decline in jury trials, they're in trial nonstop. Mm-hmm. So I think that there are definitely ways to stay on top of your game. Mm-hmm.
Drew, when we talk about restoring the jury system and you outline the various ideas that we've spoken about this last segment of the show, who needs to be exactly initiating these changes? I mean, I feel like we have a lot of good ideas about where we should be going and what needs to change, what needs to get better, but who should we be looking to actually start to make these changes possible?
Now, many of them occur at the court level, as changing whether or not jurors can ask questions, when judges' instructions are offered at the beginning of a trial, at the end of a trial, how people are incentivized to come. That's all the court level. But the most important thing and the easier thing is for attorneys to think more like jurors and less like law professors. You know, as I keep saying, to present stories, to see trials as a contest of storytellers, not as a contest of evidence perceivers. And that's very hard for many attorneys. Attorneys are really trained to believe in evidence instead of to believe in stories. Yet all the psychological research points out that jurors, our brains evolve to tell stories. Really important research by Daniel Kahneman, won a Nobel Prize. He points out that there's two kinds of thinking, fast thinking and slow thinking, and the slow, methodical, statistical thinking that is part of evaluating evidence. Jurors can't do that. Instead, they do the fast, intuitive, automatic decision-making, which Kahneman calls fast thinking. So attorneys have to know that that's what jurors are doing. That's what the brain mm-hmm. is doing. That's how the brain evolved. So they have to meet the brain where the brain is and tell a story. And that's something that attorneys can learn to do more easily if they really work on it.
That's all the time we have this morning. I want to thank my guest, Drew Sherrod, the author of The Jury Crisis, which is out now, as well as Darlene Harris, a criminal defense attorney right here in Mecklenburg County. Thank you all so much for your time. I'm Sarah D'Elia, filling in for Mike Collins. This has been Charlotte Talks.
Charlotte Talks is sponsored by Mazda of South Charlotte, dedicated to helping customers select vehicles that fit one's lifestyle. More at MazdaofSouthCharlotte.com.